My name's Sandy Adams, and I've been looking at Agenda 21 2030 and looking into the whole green agenda for a long time, for well over 17 years. I was a member of the Ecology Party in the mid 80s to early 90s, and I saw a distinct takeover really when it stopped being the Ecology Party, it became the Green Party. And it was a very corporate model, and it was all about climate change. And instead of being a kind of grassroots ecology, conservation, anti-pollution, common sense party, it became this radicalized, rather, the ecology went out the window, and it became sort of madly into climate change, and we've got to save the planet, and we've got to do X, Y, and Z to do so. And you know what happened then.
Well, yeah, but there is a certain sense to that, isn't there? I mean, I think for many of us growing up, the extremes of corporate pollution, whether it's either in the soil, the sea, the air, you know, that's something which is quite normal and natural for people to be concerned about. These corporations who've managed, whether it's through the control of the and diluting of regulations in individual countries, or simply doing it, say, out at sea, where nobody knows what they're up to. This is a genuine concern.
It is indeed. And what happened is the real green movement, the ecology movement, which was all about, you know, common sense, conservation and all that stuff, got hijacked by the mad stuff, which is actually quite anti-biology. It's like, you know, it's supporting a lot of the technocracy, a lot of the technology that's coming in. And so where is the sense in that when it's anti-human at the moment?
Yeah, talking about technology, I think we have to mention my old school friend Nick Land, Nick the Nazi.
Yes.
I mean, his influence seems to have been enormous, actually. You know, he's influenced people like Yuval Noah Harari, yeah. Peter Thiel. This idea that, you know, that life would be better if we had computers running everything.
Yeah. It's a very, very strange futurist ideology, isn't it? I mean, these futurists, I honestly think they're anti-God, they're anti- anti-creation, they're anti-human, anti-biology. They really are bonkers, and I'm sorry, that's the only word I can think of for them. You know, when you hear what they're saying, when they're saying, you know, in the future everyone will not actually be able to. They actually have something called reality privilege, which where you live in the metaverse, because you know you're so restricted by all the climate change restrictions. You're living in your smart city apartment, you're having your everything delivered to you by drone, you don't drive a car, you just live 15 minutes from your shop, and so your world is shrunk. So what they want you to do is live your life through a virtual reality headset. It's just bonkers how they can actually believe.
Well, yeah, it sounds that, but there is a psychological aspect to all of this. It's a bit little bit like, you know, back when we were kids, Sandy, you know, everyone kind of went around on public transport mostly. There were a few cars around. We would go on the train. We'd sit next to people. We'd chit chat. You know, this is a very public thing. And nowadays, everyone is kind of being atomized, aren't they? The idea is to put you in a little cell. You're not really talking to anybody else. The only communications you're getting are through the official mass media.
Exactly. And that's how, in a way, it serves them. It serves them because they're controlling your mind. And let's face it, with Neuralink, that is kind of what they want to do. They want to control every part of you. They want to, you know, sort of turn you part human, part machine. You know, the whole thing is...
Do you want to just say something about this Neuralink? What's that?
Well, that's Elon Musk's inserting a chip into the brain so that it interfaces with the technology. And you know they've already experimented on people and animals with Neuralink, and it's an interface between the human mind and the computer, and so you literally you can interface with your own computer through your mind. I mean it's horrible. It's an abomination, really. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think one of the first times, and I'm a former Green Party member, of ecology voter, I think, when my very first vote when I was aged 18. But to see the way this has kind of changed, I think it's important to sort of look at their individual specific policies of the Greens. My big wake up call in terms of, you know, literally a my God moment was interviewing the leader of the Greens on Bristol City Council. She's a physicist, and I started asking her about 5G and these mobile networks, quoting various figures to the massive amount of energy they use. In fact, many of these data centres are in Ireland, and Ireland's power generation just simply cannot cope with the amount of electricity that they need. She just had nothing to say whatsoever on the matter. And she's an expert, she's a physicist, and she completely shied away from any kind of understanding that maybe fiber optics, which use virtually no energy, are better than having these mobile networks blanketing the entire world. So what do you make of their policy around energy?
Well, you see, the thing is that they... What they really want to do is force everyone onto electric, obviously. And you know, there's a move at the moment to get rid of wood burning stoves in Gloucestershire and London. Sadiq Khan's trying to get rid of wood burners. So what it's doing is it's forcing you onto an electric grid, which is far more easier to control for them than people having autonomous ways of heating or lighting or anything else. What I'm seeing here is a big move towards getting, you know, replacing everything with ground source heat pumps that don't work properly. It's a system that's set to fail, because you've only got to have an outage, some kind of, you know, breakdown in the electricity grid, and then everybody gets very cold and literally that everybody's reliant on electricity, which isn't really a good way of serving us. And, you know, the new energy bill that's going through Parliament at the moment is horrendous. It gives the government powers to actually enter your home and forcibly put smart meters in, things like that, and do anything for any reason. They can actually forcibly enter your home. So I just think the whole thing, the energy policies, really, it's to hike up the prices as well. They have then the means to hike up massive price, and they're doing it now anyway, but there's no cap on it. They can just keep hiking the prices up. And
once you're dependent on electricity for all your energy, and you're not allowed to burn the piles of nicely seasoned wood that are out the back of the house, you're not allowed to do that. And what about, I mean, one of the biggies for me as well is nuclear. I mean, certainly the Green movement recognized that nuclear power was really part of the weapons program. It wasn't just about power at all. It was an excuse to be able to power plants were really there to manufacture plutonium for bombs, extremely expensive things. And not only that, there's a massive amount of mining of uranium goes on to destroy the ecology, as well as what on earth you're going to do with all this highly radioactive waste, and you've got to transport it around the country. This is a massive hazard. So, you know, quite rightly, Greens always saw nuclear as a total disaster. Let's never go that way. And yet George Monbiot, just after the Fukushima accident in Japan, suddenly, you know, outed himself as someone who's pro-nuclear. He's saying, oh, this is perfectly green. It's really good. It's, you know, it's zero carbon. And we still keep hearing that. So how can a Green go from all this awareness of the damage that nuclear causes, the permanent damage, the invisible radiation that can be killing generations into the future, to embracing it, as the Scottish Greens have already done, and the UK Greens seem to be totally in denial, but they're quietly doing it too?
Well, do you know, there's nothing at all that makes sense of this push for electric, you know, particularly the EV batteries. You know, these children are dying in the Congo, mining all the lithium and the cobalt for these batteries. And the batteries are indestructible. You can't get rid of them. The same with the wind turbines. You can't destroy them. They are indestructible. So they're not recyclable. There's nothing green about them. There's nothing green about anything at the moment, really, much that's going on. And the fact is that they argue that the new technology of nuclear is transformed, that it is actually safe, it is green. I don't know. I haven't looked into that, but I doubt it. And what is so ridiculous is China and India are still burgeoning ahead with their nuclear policies, pushing out emissions into the atmosphere, and yet ours are a fraction, and yet we're being hit by all this. So why would that be if they didn't want to destroy the West? That is it.
Maybe you're right. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you mentioned wood burning stoves, but you know we've got this big power station that used to be a coal fired power station, Drax, up in Yorkshire, which is actually, as was explained in various films, probably the most easy to watch and understand and professionally made is Michael Moore's Planet of the Humans, which explains how literally forests are being chopped down, fed into these little wood chip machines, and now burnt in Drax. So what they're saying is, and also they're saying that even once new nuclear power stations like Hinkley C come online, Drax is going to have to stay there and be burning these wood chips. I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you?
You couldn't make it up.
Because what happens if the nuclear power station has to shut down for a few days or a few weeks or months? Then Drax will start firing up again and burning this wood, and yet you're not allowed to burn any of it in your own home.
I know. I mean, Drax is burning wood. I mean, what's so ridiculous is that a lot of the trees that are being planted now will end up being shipped over to Canada to be processed into the pellets, then shipped back to Drax to be burnt. I mean, you couldn't make it up. That is the most ridiculous non-green, process, because you're shipping stuff across the world to turn it into pellets, which also has its own carbon footprint if you want to go down that route, and then shipping it back to Drax to burn, and we're not, you're right, we're not allowed to use wood burners. The whole thing is mad. And I was told the other day that there's the land grab that's going on with the tenant farmers. A lot of that is about planting trees. They've taken a lot of the land back to plant trees. Those trees are being will end up in as wood pellets. I mean, you couldn't make it up. I mean, it's just
it does seem as if really the idea really is to completely control us through making sure that we have to pay for everything that we used to get. I mean, so for example, if you go back hundreds of years. Before the days of enclosure in medieval villages, all the local people just went out to their nearby woods, chopped down a tree every once in a while, or maybe they were just fallen trees. They bring them back and they use them to burn those in their homes to keep them warm through the winter. Nowadays, everything has got to go through money and through an electricity bill. So it does strike me that a lot of this is just trying to force people to get onto the money system, literally for all their basic everyday needs. But look, what about farming? Because I know there's this reasonably new organisation called the PFFA, which is trying to link up farmers directly with consumers to bypass the supermarkets and bypass everybody who's trying to regulate them into the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think the People's Food and Farming Alliance, I mean, they're doing a good job. There's only one problem I had was that really the farmers should be being encouraged to keep their farms. And as you say, to bring it all, bring it all to the open market with and cut out the supermarkets. That would be great. But at the moment, that isn't actually working like that, because the farmers are giving up. They're literally giving up, and British farmers are. I mean, I think there's more of a fight in somewhere like Holland, because they saw the deception. They saw the deception about the nitrogen, and they've really come out against it because they know it's a nonsense. I mean, they devised a method of separating the manure from the urine so that it would actually work better, so the nitrogen wouldn't be a problem. And of course now, that was ignored by their government. And we know now that it's a land grab. I mean, the fact is that they literally are using it to I think it's a bit like a mass appropriation of land for the government, for the Dutch government.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just a bit, you know, I do think about Gaza. This is a land grab by other means. And this is a similar thing.
Yeah. They're doing it to the world.
So let's just look at what's happening with, look at specifically what's happening with British farmers. Two main things, it seems to me, and maybe you can help me here, is first of all, there are increasing regulations on farmers to say they've got to take land out of their farm and set it aside for wildlife and nature, which obviously, I mean, that's a big hit for a farmer to suddenly there's a whole load of land that they've just got to set aside, as we, you know, this is an expression we've known ever since the Common Agricultural Policy. They're not allowed to use. But the thing is, with the old set aside system, with the Common Agricultural Policy, they used to get paid to leave that land free. Now they're not going to be paid to put this land into. But they're also increased costs with energy, which are forcing farmers much closer to the line, particularly if they've borrowed money to buy land or to buy new equipment for their farm. They're suddenly finding, oh dear, look, we're actually not making any money. And then thirdly, you know, you've got the immense power of the supermarkets now, price fixing, and some of the figures for the amount of money that farmers are being paid for produce, milk and things like this, compared to what the supermarkets are selling for, is quite obviously market fixing, you know, price fixing. So there's a lot of pressure on these farmers. So you're saying that a lot of them are just caving in, Sandy?
A lot of them are, because I think, I mean, we've got to look at the bigger picture here. I mean, farmers have always, you know, they've been under the Common Agricultural Policy. They've been seduced by subsidies since we joined the EU, really. And they've been reliant on those subsidies, and they've got used to having them. And now they're taking away, obviously, the Common Agricultural Policy and replacing it with the Sustainable Farming Incentive, the SFI, they call it, which they've been told. I mean, particularly they're targeting meat and dairy. Meat and dairy's got to go. In the whole net zero scam, meat and dairy has to go. And the way they can do this is by saying to farmers, right, you've got 3 years to phase out your meat and dairy or to reduce it. Not necessarily phase it out. They want it phased out by 2030. But between now and 2030, they've got to reduce it. And they said, you've got to reduce it by whatever amount it is. And they say, you know, you've got to set up businesses other than meat and dairy on your farm. And those businesses can be anything. It can be. And this is where they're taking their subsidies away over a 3-year increment. So by, I think it's 2027, the meat and dairy will be reduced. So therefore, they can set up other, they said you can do glamping, you can do dog walking pens, you can do, they had all these ideas, obviously photovoltaics, wind farms, you know, they really want them to take up sustainables. And housing, you'll see a lot more housing going up on farming land. And if you look at the North Somerset mapping through the council, and their projection for, I think it's 2040 something or other, is literally all of the agricultural land is covered in photovoltaics and wind farms and housing. So where are the sheep and the cows going to go? That, well, there isn't any room. There's none. There's nothing. There's no. What really gets me about a lot of these planning mapping systems for sustainable development within councils is that there is no food security whatsoever. There's nothing about food security in any of these councils. And that is an abomination, actually, because food security is one of, I think it's one of the 13 principles of government to secure. And it's not happening. And in my view, this is a bigger picture of literally keeping us hungry, cold, and poor, because there will be a massive knock-on effect to all of this. Because if you take out meat and dairy, because they're trying to force us onto the bugs and the 3D printed meat, fake meat that Gates has got all sewn up. You know, they're trying to push this agenda. I don't personally think it's going to work. People are going to see through all this, because at the moment there will be food shortages. We've got Ukraine, which was a bed. You know, big bread basket. That's not happening. They've shut down the Dutch farming virtually. That's not happening. That's a massive, massive meat and dairy industry and crops. And the trouble is that all of this is almost like a perfect storm. When you've got the weather that we've had, there's nothing being planted in the UK at the moment much because of the weather. So you've got this perfect storm of food shortages. And, you know, in the US, you've got bridges collapsing and food plants going up in smoke. This is all orchestrated. I can't tell you. It's a massive, massive push to actually.
Okay, so is the purpose, you know, the purpose of this, well, I suppose you could call it economic warfare, really, against the public to make them impoverished. Is that the idea, to sort of level Britain up with, say, a country like the Congo? So is that the idea?
Well, this is what was mapped out in the Club of Rome report, Our Common Future. It's making us all equally poor. We're turning into a third world country, Tony. Honestly, I'm astounded at what's happening to our country.
The third world model, for those people who visited the developing world, like South America — I spent quite a while in South America — is that you've got a tiny elite who don't allow any kind of real political process to take place, so that for the 99.9% of the population have got absolutely no say whatsoever. They have a kind of sham election. And that does look like what's happening here with Sunak and Starmer in Britain now, is both of these individuals are signed up to all the same agreements, and both seem to be really just two, you know, the A team of the and the B team of the Neoconservative Party.
And I think, you see, also they'll bring rationing in. I mean, that's another way of, you know, if you want to control a whole nation, control their food and their energy. And I can see that coming as well with they'll bring in some sort of rationing. It'll be some kind of, it'll be a digital food stamp or something, that or carbon credits, where you literally, you know, you've got your allocated amount of energy, you've got allocated amount of food, and that's your lot. And it will be like being in a third world country if we allow this to carry on, this nonsense, this misinformation.
Well, that's a good question. Will we? I mean, another thing which is part of all of this is the lack of access to the countryside. So part of this Natural England and these various environmental government groups are saying, well, more and more lands needs to be set aside for wildlife. And, you know, no, I don't have a problem with wildlife, but they're implying that the people should not be allowed to walk anywhere near where wildlife are. Now, hang on a minute. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I like going for walks in the countryside, is when you come across a deer, maybe you see a hare, you get a photograph, or, you know, this is the idea that people and wildlife are not compatible is really, it's a bizarre, bizarre thing. But anyway, you mentioned Our Common Future. You mentioned the Club of Rome. Can you talk about some of the other organisations that have been pushing this agenda, and, you know, take us through a bit of a timeline?
Oh, well, a timeline is, it's difficult because it's been going on for such a long time. I mean, if you wanted to go back, you know, to Cecil Rhodes, God, I mean, you know, it's almost like the Club of the Isles, you know, the Empire stuff. You know, it's all about having, you know, seizing people's land in order to keep the resources. And I think resources, when you've got limits to growth, which was the very first Club of Rome report that came out prior to the Earth Summit to make up, to be part of Agenda 21. That was all about the humans versus, humans and population versus resources. And they were saying in 1971, oh, there's not enough to go round. You know, by 1980, there'll be famines, there'll be this, there'll be that. Well, of course, it was all nonsense. It was all computer modeled, because actually...
Well, hang on, just a minute, because the limits to growth surely is a sensible idea. There's this effort to get to squeeze more and more growth out of every economy, which is surely eventually is bound to hit the buffers. What you're doing is you're trying to get more and more profit out of what is actually a limited amount of not only purchasing power and needs for the public, but also limited resources. So, you know, growth could, you can't, you know, surely you can't imagine a world where you've got this constant growth the whole time. The economy's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. At some point, it's going to have to hit the buffers.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree that economic growth out of control, which is what it could do with out of control capitalism. Yes, that's fine. But what they did was they created computer models to exaggerate it with limits to growth. It was all based on computer models with quite wild assumptions that if it goes on by 1980, you could have this, that, and the other, you know, going on. You wouldn't have enough resources to go round. But what they didn't take into account was that actually the population was in some areas was declining, particularly Europe. I mean, Europe, we're not even at replacement level, you know, with our population. We've got with migrant population, of course. Then they say, oh, problem, reaction, solution. We'll bring in migrant population to make up for the shortfall. Well, that's all very well, but that is out of control as well. So you know, there's a lot of things at play here. And yes, you know, rampant commercialism that goes beyond, you know, a sustainable point has to be looked at. But you know, that there are ways of doing this without using the methods that the climate change are, because there's no rhyme or reason to that. When you get, you know, I think it's 60 billion euros on, in Europe alone for the transformation to the digital, the digital whole ID thing. You know, there's money being wasted on these green initiatives that could be put to more sort of natural stuff. Like,
I'm trying to sort of step back from this a bit. It seems to me what's going on is there's a big change to do with the essentials of life. So that's things like housing, energy, food, the very basics that we all need just to live from day to day. The emphasis all seems to be on controlling that rather than, looking at the innovation that capitalism traditionally has done. Building a better widget, building aircraft, whatever, building a car, all the technology, the new technology. No, they're going back to this idea of all the basic things that people need, water, things like that. Let's put the price of that up and control it.
The fact that all of this is being driven by a new economy, and it is all based on, obviously, carbon credits. And you know, that the land at the moment, the whole thing about land in the UK, well, let's just take the UK, for instance, and this has happened all over the world. You've got this financial instrument called biodiversity net gain, which was brought in I think it was 2020. And if you like, it's the same. The whole carbon economy is exactly the same. They're just replacing like for like. The carbon economy is now taking over the price-based economy that we had. So that's why they're trying to get rid of cash. So everything is based on tokenization, carbon tokens. And this is why cash will, you know, they're wanting cash out way. And they've already set up all these financial instruments with the World Bank, the IMF, the Bank of International Settlements. They've all got this all ready to go into this into the normal banks. So what happens is that if you have land, you will get, and it's the same as the ESGs, the environmental social governance contracts with businesses. If you're not actually running your business to some sort of green tariff, and you're falling behind with your sustainability score, and it's just like the Chinese social credit score, your business gets taken away. And it's the same with the land, or gets closed down, and then it goes into the hands of people that will run it properly.
Hang on, you've just mentioned China there. This does sound like it's got a lot of similarities with the Chinese Communist Party system, doesn't it?
That is exactly what we're living under. We're living under Chinese social credit system. I mean, this is extraordinary, really, that it's got this far. But our land, if you've got any land at all, and it's even though it's your land, it will be controlled by the government or global governance by the fact that you will be then scored on your biodiversity net gain. How sustainable is your land? If your land isn't sustainable enough, then you are not allowed to use it. It will be somehow confiscated because you are not doing something that's in the interests of the collective.
Well, that's amazing. That's all happened under a Conservative government, which is supposed to be the party of the landowners.
But, you know, Tony, you go on about Conservatives and Labour. There's no such thing. It's a blooming uni party. It's all under global governance now. The World Economic Forum and the WHO and the United Nations are controlling all our governance. It wouldn't matter who gets in. It's still there. And unless the people stop complying to it, nothing will happen. I mean, it'll just go ahead.
I noticed recently they're even talking about you've got to have to register your chickens. And I do look at that, you know, like the sort of, you know, to have a cow with a tag in its ear. You're going to have the same with all your chickens. I just don't think this is practical, all of this stuff. People are just really not going to do it. You mentioned Agenda 2030, this idea that there may be no lamb around, there may be no beef around by 2030. Who's invented this Agenda 2030? Where's it come from? Because it does look as if this is a major aim of the globalists, of the plutocrats that actually now run things, it seems, via regulations like the UN. And I first came across your work, Sandy, during the plandemic, which was World Health Organization, which is another UN organization. You know, there seems to be a very, very big push towards this global governance. But what about this Agenda 2030? Because one thing I do know is we're supposed to be following these things called the Sustainable Development Goals towards this Agenda 2030.
Mm. Well, Agenda 2030 is just a goal. The meat and bones of the agenda is Agenda 21, and that was brought together at the Earth Summit in 1992 by, I have to say, a bunch of oil billionaires and bankers who decided that they wanted to control every resource on the planet. And that sounds like a some kind of Bond film, but that's exactly what happened. It was put together over a series of 20 years prior, from the 1970s, even before that, actually. If you really want to go back to the technocracy movement of the 1930s, you had M.K. Hubbard and Alexander King, who was a founder member of the Club of Rome. They were social engineers and they were Columbia University, and they wanted to replace capitalism with an energy-based economy, basically. And they did very well. They put out this energy-based economy, and Elon Musk's grandfather got involved in this, Joshua Haldeman, and he was a bit of a maverick. He joined up with Columbia University, and he had his own thing called the Social Credit Party. Can you believe that? In 1930 to 1947, he had a party called the Social Credit, and it was all based on carbon credits and social social equity and social justice and social social credit, really, you know. And the whole thing was quite communistic in its own funny way, or totalitarian even. And anyway, it failed because World War II kicked in and America wasn't ready to let go of capitalism at that time. And so it went. And then it was reborn in 1970 by Zbigniew Brzezinski as he called it the New Economic Order. He rebirthed the technocracy movement of the 1920s. He rebirthed it in the 1970s. And this is where sort of, you know, everybody got on board with Big Society, Cameron and all that lot. And what happened is that it became a sort of mantra to bring the world together under a common crisis, which was climate. So they chose climate. And they'd chosen that from in the 1991 in a Club of Rome report called The First Global Revolution, where it actually says, you know, we need a common crisis to unite humanity because we need an enemy, because all the enemies are gone. You know, the Cold War was over, the world wars were over, and the wall had come down in Czechoslovakia and Russia and all that. So what they did was they thought, right, okay, let's let's turn it into the Berlin Wall come down. Let's turn it into a way of getting something that would unite humanity under a common enemy. And the enemy, we were identified as the enemy because they said it would be, we could use famine, we could use flooding, we could use global warming, we could use this. Well, they called it global warming then. And they said, we thought global warming fit the bill. So that was in 1991. Then there was a big meeting held by Prince Charles, actually, on Royal Yacht Britannia in Rio de Janeiro Harbour to bring in all there was Edmund de Rothschild, Al Gore, Maurice Strong, who was the head of the General Secretary of the United Nations at the time, and all the movers and shakers that could bring this about, all the bankers and billionaires of the world. And he held that on Royal Yacht Britannia, and he'd already set up the I think it was called the Prince of Wales Business Leaders Forum, which was the beginnings of the PPPs, you know, public-private partnerships. They've got it all planned out, this lot. And so they decided to come back a year later and hold the Earth Summit. And that's what they did. And again, Prince Charles was there in Royal Britannia, in Rio de Janeiro Harbour. And they got 178 countries to sign up to global governance. And that's what they wanted. They wanted the resources of the world. They knew that fiat currency was over. All there's left is the resources, and they want them. So they got 178 countries to sign up to say, if you don't sign this up, the planet's going to die under global warming. So that was the heist, really. And then they implemented it, and it's accelerated it every year now up until in 2015. It wasn't moving fast enough. So because they'd made, I think it was 8 goals, which were the Millennium Goals, which would take us up to 2000. Now, those had failed. The eight Millennium Goals had failed. They were similar to the 17 goals. So they accelerated it. And in 2015, Obama flew into Rome and the Pope endorsed and they launched the 17 goals of Agenda 2030. And those had to be done by 2030. So that's where Agenda 2030 comes in. Now, it's a bit of a story, but since then, obviously, it didn't move quite fast enough. And they've got these goals. And if you look at the 17 goals, they are very, very sugar-coated. They sound wonderful. It's like end all poverty, stop hunger. But what it does is end all poverty is make everybody equally poor. You know, end all hunger is controlling the food chain and having Monsanto and literally destroying decent food for factory farmed food in a mass sort of horrible way, you know, sort of 3D printed meat and bugs. You know, that's their idea of feeding the world. And they want to control everything on a global level. And that's what it is.
Well, look, okay, so here's what I'm sure if he were with us now, King Charles would say is hang on, Sandy, we've had for centuries bad distribution of food across the planet. The Sustainable Development Goals will mean probably less food being available in the developed world so that we don't have these starving millions anymore.
Yes, but why was Africa so suppressed? I mean, Africa is a very resourceful country. If they hadn't been plundered for centuries, they would be a very prosperous country. I mean, it's all been manipulated. All of this has been manipulated. And even the growth of the West has been manipulated. So all I'm saying is that they could have been a far more equitable way of doing this, but actually it's all about control.
Well, one thing I must agree with you on is Africa particularly. I mean, what we saw was the African countries' colonial powers withdrawing after the Second World War, only to be replaced by puppet leaders. And if any local person made it to be a leader, then they were just bumped off by the Western, MI6 and these intelligence services. So they decided to, rather than to directly control these countries, to do this kind of neo-colonial thing where we'll just control, have a few puppet people, a bit like the Romans, you know, they used to like to have local people running their territories for them. But anyway, look, what about, how do you think that by 2030, any of these goals will be achieved? And how do you think they're going in the process?
Well, I've got to be the eternal optimist. Otherwise, I'd be jumping off Beachy Head with a bottle of vodka because I know too much. I know what they're up to. And sometimes you wake up and you think, oh, God, how can all this actually reverse? But I have eternal optimism because people have to people are really beginning to see what this is really about. And there's a few things that will happen, and it's a bit like I'm just praying for the 100 monkey syndrome, where because it gets to a tipping point of conscious awareness of what's going on, that actually it then becomes almost like a tsunami, where even though there may, you know, there's, it's almost like a tsunami of conscious, you know, that it sort of awakens in everyone, and everyone goes, oh my God, this is happening, and that humanity stand up against this, because we certainly have, there's not one, well, there's one politician maybe, but there's hardly any politicians all over the world who are standing up for the people. It's just unbelievable, really, that most of the countries.
Who is this one politician then, Sandy?
Well, is it Andrew Bridgen? A lot of people, you know, he's standing up and doing the, you know, saying the right things. I hope, you know, we don't. What do we know?
Well, there are one or two. You know, I've seen George Galloway. George Galloway also standing up and saying some interesting things. I mean, there seems to be always a few, very very tiny number allowed around the fringes, but none of these people will ever make it into government simply because they're not obedient enough to the plutocrats. You know, whatever. But anyway, look, what about this whole idea of the Great Reset? How does that fit in to what you've been talking about?
Well, the reset is really, it is Agenda 2030. It's 2030, but rebranded. And it's a whole social engineering project, and a whole reset of the way that society works. And of course, what they really want is for everyone to live by their rules and regulations and on their terms, and it's a way of having global governance in every single country in the world, and resetting the whole planet, and having everything under sustainable development. So you are highly regulated. You live in 50-minute cities. You have not very much access to the countryside. I mean, it's almost like a Hunger Games situation. And they're controlling. I mean, if you look at the C40 cities, this is what it's going to be like. The C40 cities, do look at the C40 cities website. I mean, this was brought about in the 1990s by Carlos Moreno, Boris Johnson, Ken Livingston. It was an initiative for a global reset of every city and every town in the world, basically. And they've even got a planetary diet, you know, sorted out, that you live by. Have a look at the website. I mean, it's unbelievable. And you see then how big this global push is, and that this is where the 15-minute cities came from. It's no way. I mean, in my town, they say, oh, it's a nice grassroots thing, so you get everywhere in 50 minutes and you cycle everywhere. Yeah, that's true. But actually, you're also heavily restricted and you're zoned. And if you talk to anybody in Cambridge and Oxford and Canterbury, you'll see what a misery it is living in a 15-minute city. And this is what they have planned, but they'll extend that to climate lockdowns. And that is beginning to come in as well. So
what the problem with the 15 minutes is, what happens if you've got close relatives that live near your town? Yeah. You want to visit them two or three times a week, maybe an elderly relative that needs some care, and you're going to have to pass through five or six different zones in order to get there, and there's no public transport. You know, are you going to have to cycle in the wind and the rain, even if you're in your 60s and 70s and in the middle of winter? You know, there doesn't seem to be any kind of humanity
there
to
isn't.
This. But look, interesting to hear that the Great Reset is really so connected up with these sustainable development goals and the Agenda 20. It's really just kind of different logos. It's a bit like the petrol companies. When we go down the high street and see Texaco, Shell, BP, whatever, you know, there are different ways of selling the same monopoly, you know, the same conglomerate, you know, conglomo. Mm. But look, what about this Green New Deal? I recently saw a video by Corey Morningstar about this. What she's saying is really, maybe, I don't know if it's similar to what you're saying, is this idea of basically digitizing the entire planet so that every single resource, every tree, every square inch of growing land or allotment is all going to be digitized and controlled. And the idea is that that's really what a lot of this is about, is literally commodifying everything. A bit like, you know what, it reminded me a bit of like the Doomsday Book back in 1086. Yes. Where they went around just kind of writing a list of all of the resources so that they could tax everything very precisely. And actually, there were, people don't realize this, back in early medieval, just after the Norman invasion of Britain, there were massive riots. These guys going around with clipboards for William the Conqueror actually were attacked. He's like, no, go away. You know, we don't want you knowing exactly what's going on here, because we know that you're just going to come and take your pound of flesh from here. And you're already incredibly wealthy. And so we don't want this kind of system. So in a way, any pushback against this Green New Deal and the digitizing of everything is similar to what we had to put up with back in Norman times. Anyway, look, what is this? Maybe you can just say something about the Green New Deal and about Corey and her work.
Yeah, oh, Corey Morningstar's amazing. I adore her. I mean, she was the one that wrote about the, what's her name, Greta Thunberg, and she was amazing. And she's a fantastic researcher, and she's absolutely right. I mean, the Green New Deal is all about the financialization of the planet. I mean, that's what we're looking at, and this is all being done through financial instruments that the banks and the credit card company, everybody are buying into this whole green economy and reset of the price-based economy and replacing it with the energy-based economy, exactly what they were trying to do in the 1930s. And it is a way, and they can do it now, you see, because they've got the technology. They can actually people will have to have some means of they're calling it stewardship, stewardship of the planet. But what it is, it's actually a means of collecting money for the banks. And stewardship is turned into tokenization and also sort of being able to assess your sustainability. And if you don't come up to scratch, then you're penalized. And if you do, then they collect the money. And that's what it is.
It's so fascinating, isn't it? Because land ownership is one of those very basic things, like, you know, people have got a freehold in their home. They is the an Englishman's home is his castle, this sort of thing. But of course, see, the same is true for a farmer. But what the new system means is that you own the land, but we are going to tell you what you do with it. So of course, this is totally undermining this idea of owning your own farm or whatever. You don't really own it, because you can only own it if you do what you're told.
Yeah. And my question is, says who? And, you know, what gives them the right to assume control over your land by the means that they're doing that is a big fat lie. It's net zero. It's a big fat lie. The whole thing is a lie.
Well, hang on. Well, why is net zero a big fat lie? Because everybody knows that by producing less carbon, you're helping save the planet.
No, you're not. You're destroying the planet because CO2 actually makes things grow, and it's a reversal of everything that's true. And we know that CO2. Farmers put it in their greenhouses to make things grow. Nothing grows without CO2. If CO2 goes to under a certain level, and I think Patrick Moore quotes this, I wish I had the quote on me, but I haven't. He quotes this, Patrick Moore, who used to be the CEO of Greenpeace. He said, if you destroy CO2, you know, you're literally killing the planet. You know, there's no point in, you know, there's no biological life. So why, if it's net zero, and actually the absolute zero is saying absolute zero, and this I'm amazed that the absolute zero document that was commissioned by our government From I think it was Cambridge and Oxford universities, was debated in the House of Lords. It's called Absolute Zero, the UK Fires Absolute Zero document, which says no flying or shipping out of the UK by 2030. That's a prison island then. No, nothing imported, nothing exported, no planes, nothing, no shipping. And then we grow nothing. What does that mean? And all of this, that was debated in the House of Lords to be put into immediate effect. And that was in 2020, something like that. And you just think, how could these people be bought into the fact that absolute zero is a good thing? Nothing will grow. Talk to any farmer, any biologist. It's bonkers. And it's all predicated on a big lie. They're destroying our world under a big lie.
This whole idea of getting rid of meat, let's just bite the bullet on this for a minute, because there is another agenda going on at the same time, which is this whole pantheist thing. The idea is really to revert back to pagan times where humans are equated with animals. Mm. So we're just animals. And if you kill a sheep, you kill a cow. If you kill a chicken, you're killing a human. It's the same sort of, and actually what I've been seeing quite a lot of is saying, well, actually, the things like the slaughter of the Gazans by the Israeli Defense Force, this is the same as like an abattoir where you're killing animals. So can you say something about that? Because that seems to be the sort of message that's coming across. And this, let me just, say something about it, because this is this was actually a Himmlerian idea, a Nazi idea that actually eulogized these powerful things like the aurochs, these powerful cattle that they had. They thought these were fantastic. I mean, oh yes, the Nazis ate them, but they started the process of making out that many of these animals were almost like gods. You know, I mean, obviously Hitler was their big god, but there seems to be this almost quasi-spiritual, quietly thing going on in the background with the pantheists saying, actually, we need to look after animals because they're just like humans, and we're animals too.
The thing is that it was clearly defined in our, hopefully, we are above the animal kingdom in as much as we sort of have morals and codes of ethics and all that kind of stuff. We were given apparently dominion over the earth.
We're far more equipped to deal with these things. We are supposed to be stewards of these things,
and we have been, and we've done it very well, and that has been taken away from us by the technocrats, who will do it very badly and destroy the earth. I mean, that, and I think that's by design. I think that's an evil force behind all that, and that's the difference, is that humans were given dominion because we could steward it in the right way.
I mean, for me, the main thing is here, it's almost like a kind of militant vegan agenda quietly hiding behind a lot of this stuff.
Mm. Well, interestingly, if you go to the Sainsbury's Future of Food report, the Sainsbury's think that they are going to actually be producing a lot of the food in the UK. And they've got a whole, go to Sainsbury's Future of Food report. It's absolutely mind-boggling, because they're talking about 3D printed meat, bugs, and octopus, and jellyfish, eating protein from all these sources, and 3D printed meat. They've got sort of, actual, sort of diagrams of all this stuff. And they've got a plan to provide the UK with food. And this is all processed under LED lights with sort of, indoor, and they want to be farmers, and they're going to be producing the most unnutritious, awful stuff.
Immediately it makes me think is that this is one of the reasons why the supermarkets have been price fixing, doubling their profits. We just had Tesco's profits massively go through the roof again. What they're doing is they're just all getting together, colluding in a cartel to force everybody. Now the supermarkets have become so dominant, to pay two or three times what they should be paying for the food, particularly, I mean, sure, the farmers would understand that. So they're ploughing these profits into becoming themselves controllers and producers of lab-produced food.
Mm. And they've got a plan from now until 2069, I think it is, or I think it's 2069. Massive plans to restructure the whole way we eat. So we're being told what to eat, when to eat, and you know, this is just awful. And because they're going to try and stop us from growing our own food.
Well, they've been doing that here in Bristol. Let me just say something about the allotment campaign here. I mean, they had 300-400% increases in allotment prices for some people. Some it was less, but enormous restrictions as well that the Bristol City Council was trying to put onto allotment owners or allotment renters. That they were, for example, if they had a shed, they would have to pay massive amounts extra for that. If there was a tree on their little plot, they would have to pay more for that. Almost everything they did wasn't just growing cabbages. And that's all been beaten down by the allotment holders here in Bristol. Many of them, of course, are retired people with enormous amounts of legal and administrative skills who've really beaten back the council. So it will be... it will be the Greens when and if they take over, as they probably will in a few weeks' time, in the local elections in Bristol. Can we just sort of wind up by talking about how, you know, what sort of questions you would ask a Green councillor if they knock on your door and say, "Well, I'm standing for the Greens, and we are going to be taking over your local authority." What questions would you have for a Green wanting your vote?
I think looking at the financialization of farming, the way that's happening, looking at the way that they're trying to financialize the planet, you know, the Greens are all on board with this. They're on board also with a lot of the technology. You know, they seem to be on board with 5G, because 5G is going to power all these super farms that they're talking about that will be corporate owned. They won't be farmers. I mean, this has all been laid out in the Agricultural Working Group report, you know, how the farms will be roboticized. And, you know, I'd be asking them about that and saying, look, what are you doing to stop that? You know, the Green New Deal is about the financialization of nature. You're behind that. What do you make of all that? And I'd probably want to sit and give them a lecture, which they'd probably not want me not want to hear. But, you know, this is it really is. It's a massive, it's like a pirating of everything that belongs to the people.
Isn't it? I mean, look, I mean, here in Bristol, main issue is probably the 15-minute cities and the clean air zone. I mean, we've got this thing now which penalises poorer drivers. I mean, they've already kept, by putting these bus gates in and things like that, and also narrowing all the roads so that you can no longer park next to the building you need to deliver to. And so if you want to have a delivery, then you have to get a fine, and the cyclists are being encouraged to take photographs of anyone that's delivering to their shop and so they can get a fine. So I mean, there's an enormous amount of restrictions already on traffic in Bristol city centre, and yet they're also fining people for driving in if they've got an older car. So the people with the brand new Chelsea tractors pay nothing. So what about this whole business of zoning the city with 15 minutes and the clean air zones?
Well, it's nothing to do with environmentalism. It's about revenue. It's about revenue and control. And there is nothing about 15-minute cities, low-traffic neighbourhoods, livable neighbourhoods, or anything else that is about environmentalism or safety. They're putting the big safety thing. Oh, it's keeping children safe. That's why you have to drive at 20 miles an hour or not go in at all. You know, the whole thing is it's a Trojan horse. It's a Trojan horse for control.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems that we've pointed out many times here in Bristol, I mean, those people with their antennae up, are that the so-called clean air zone just forces people to drive much further, producing more pollution.
Yeah. Well, you look at Oxford, everything's on the ring road and it's congested. That's causing massive pollution. People have died.
Oxford Ring Road was already very congested in the first place. So
now it's much, much worse. And people have died, you know, trying to get through the traffic and ambulances.
So also just one other person I know that was a bit of an inspiration for you was Rosa Corey. Can you just say a bit about her and, you know, her, yeah. how she got onto all this stuff?
Well, there's two people. There's also Nikki Rapana, and Nordica Friedrich, who wrote the Anti-Communitarian Manifesto. And a lot of Rosa's work was taken from their work, but she expanded on it because Rosa Corey was this amazing land appraiser. She was a land appraiser in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And she very early on in the early 2000s late 90s, she couldn't work out why land was being seized under what was called sustainable development. And that was everything started off in America much quicker than here. We've only just got cottoned on to all of this. And of course, she began to question it and looked and then realized that it was going, there were lots of backhanders going on and it was going through councils. And she stood up and she set up the whole campaign against sustainable development in the US. And she had a lot of success. And sadly, she passed away way before her time in 2021, I think it was. And weirdly, Nikki Rapana died the same year. And they were both not that old, you know. I think Rosa was only in her 50s. A big loss to everyone. But if anybody wants to read her book, Behind the Green Mask, you can get that on Amazon. And you can download Nikki Rapana and Nordica Friedrich's work, which is the, it's called Our Common Destiny, the Anti-Communitarian Manifesto, and you can get that just from, I think it's Academia, free download. And it's fascinating because it explains communitarianism, which is another talk we'll have to do, Tony, because it's so complex. Communitarianism.
One person I think we've got to end on is Christopher Booker, because he did quite a lot of work on all of this, didn't he? Yeah. Before he died, he was a very successful journalist, worked for the Daily Telegraph. Just say something about him?
Well, Christopher Booker, he was a bit of a hero, really. I met him quite by accident when I was sandbagging down at the Somerset Levels in 2014. And, you know, all the Sky News and everywhere were on the bridge, you know, filming the level of the Parrot rising, the River Parrot rising. And there was nobody there helping the locals, no one at all except a Sikh organization that had flown in from Haiti to help the people of Somerset, would you believe it? No army, no navy, no environment agency, no government. Nobody was there helping. And people were literally losing their homes and could have lost their lives, and they lost all their livestock and everything. Anyway, Christopher Booker was down there, and he was a freelance journalist for the Telegraph, and I think some other, maybe the Times, I don't know. And I got chatting to him, and he immediately said to me, "This is Agenda 21. And I said, "You know about Agenda 21? Because nobody I know was talking about it in those days. And he said, "Oh yeah." He said, "Look at policy 6 of the Environment Agency." He said this was designated as a floodplain under sustainable development. And I went and looked it up, sure enough, and I put it on my PowerPoints. And then I read his fantastic, he did I think it was called Global Warming, a study on groupthink. And that is a downloadable. Please, anybody that's listening, read it. He's a genius. He was at the Paris Climate Conference in 2015 arguing about the emissions and everything. And he was there when Trump walked out because of the emissions in India and China were way up. And our emissions weren't, and we were being sanctioned. And so he wrote this extraordinary study on groupthink, which is exactly what climate change is. It is a massive, massive brainwashing campaign. It's all based on lies, and he explains it so well. And the world is not such a good place since he left, actually. It was a better place when he was here. And as with so many
of these. An amazing writer. There are some talks by him around. I think he did the Glastonbury Symposium. One year as well.
Yes, he did, yeah.
But anyway, look, one of the things I have to say about, I don't have to say anything, but I will about the flooding of the Somerset Levels is I was I decided to go and have a look from Bristol, drove down around Bridgewater area to go and have a look at the sluice gates, because this is the obvious thing that should be happening as the levels are flooded. Is you've got all these reams which were put there hundreds of years ago, dug by the local farmers and the local authority. In fact, they were all during the Second World War, or just after the Second World War. They were all redone, you know, in these massive civil engineering projects that responsible people did in those days. And I was really quite astounded to see the Environment Agency had kept these ream sluice gates shut. So you've got all these massive drainage ditches, but even at low tide, they were holding back the water. The water was not being allowed out into the Bristol Channel, into the River Parret, etc. So this was, it's the obvious evidence is there that the flooding was deliberate. It was absolutely deliberate.
Without a doubt, there were a number of things. It's almost like the perfect storm again, isn't it? They'd cut down all the trees. I mean, it's supposed to be sort of like the Environment Agency. They cut down the trees along the Parret, which sucked up the water. They'd shut down an old munitions factory that was on the levels, which used to take a lot of the water. It was a steam. It was run on steam. And that was decommissioned in, I think, 1987. And they said, look, what are you going to do with the water that this took out of the levels when we shut it down? And they ignored that. Again, the sluice gates weren't working, the pumping stations weren't working, and they hadn't dredged the reams for decades. And so it was a deliberate sort of, if you like, sort of the infrastructure had been neglected. And it was going to happen the minute we got a massive spring rainfall. And it was more than spring rainfall. It was huge. And everything flooded. But, you know, they're aiming on doing that again. I went to a consultation only... It was just after COVID. I went to a consultation in Wedmore and they were talking about that the levels will be flooded around the Wedmore area due to sea level rise. And I took the guy to task, this guy from the Environment Agency, because the whole of the room was filled with young sustainable development and ecology students or whatever students they are, sustainable development students, I suppose. And there are lots of pictures of, you know, little fluffy animals, you know, squirrels and biodiversity and blah, 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 and ducks and wading birds. And it was, oh, we've got to save the duck biodiversity. And when the sea does reclaim the land, then we have to let it happen, sort of thing. And so I said, look, I spoke to this bloke. I said, you know, there's no sea level rise. I said, you know, Niels Axel Mourner, who was the amazing sea level rise expert, who from ex-IPCC, who I'd had, you know, we'd taken him down to Fairbourne, because they've actually got a whole managed retreat town in Wales that is being evacuated for sustainable development, you know, for the fact that it's called managed retreat. They're trying to get them all out. And there's, you know, there is no sea level rise. We know that, you know, it's a proven fact. And yet that's what they're doing. They're saying, oh, it's all going to be reclaimed by the sea. But what they're doing is they're just not maintaining the drainage. It drains now because all that drainage was put down, you know.
Well, they're pushing people out. They're pushing people out, aren't they? This is the idea. And also, for example, by having a disaster, deliberate disaster, like the flooding of the levels, you're whacking up everybody's insurance costs. In fact, you're making people's houses uninsurable as well. So you're literally forcing people out of the area, but you're saying it's all climate change.
It's all climate change. It's all climate change. And I argued with him. I said, what about policy six? And he said, oh, you know about policy six? I said, yes, I do. And he froze, actually, amazed that I knew about policy six.
Yeah, in a way, you see, Sandy, I think, you know, what they did with the levels was so brazen. It's interesting because both you and I, you know, living close to it, did look beyond what was the spin the BBC were putting on it all. And nobody reported the fact that the reams weren't being allowed to drain the water into the sea at low tide. I mean, we've got a massive low. I mean, I think it's something like 11 metres that the sea goes up and down more than anywhere else in the world. So it's very easy to get this stuff out through these drainage ditches, but they just simply weren't doing it. Anyway, look, For keeping up to date with what you're up to, your talks and articles and things like that, whereabouts should listeners go, Sandy?
I'm actually redoing my website, so don't go there yet, because I'm putting a whole load of more stuff up on it. But I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, and I'm writing a book at the moment, so I'm trying to conserve a lot of my time. I'm speaking at the Glastonbury Symposium on the 26th of July. I'm speaking in Stenning in Sussex on the 11th of May with Mike Robinson from UK Column. That is at, I can't remember the name of the place. It's some hall in Stenning. Oh my God, my brain's gone. I'll have to send it to you and you must put it out. I think it's the... it's a hall in Stenning. Sorry, my brain's gone, and I'm
well,
not.
Don't worry. That's fine. Anyway, I mean, you know, I'm sure we can manage to find it. Go to Stenning and ask around. You know.
Yeah. It's in Stenning in Sussex, and we're going to be talking a lot about the empire stuff there, which is quite interesting. I'll be talking
what
about.
What do you
my
mean normal... by that?
Well, it,
what do you mean by the empire?
The empire. What do I mean by the empire? You see, I've got this. I'm not going to be talking about that specifically. I think there's a couple of people who are more sort of up on it than me. But quite honestly, I don't think the empire ever went away. And I think that a lot of this is almost like it's oligarchies getting together and deciding to do deals and control everything across the world. And we can't forget that the Crown Corporation is the most influential, financial sort of body in the entire world. So that has to mean something. And we're all, you know, we all think that our monarchy are all, you know, being destroyed. And I think it's all probably a bit of a cycle.
No. Well, it certainly isn't, is it? I mean, look at King Charles. No. He's been at the middle of this right the way through. And not only that, I mean, I don't know if I can say he murdered his wife. I mean, he certainly was complicit in the getting rid of Diana, who was killed unlawfully. That was the verdict of the coroner.
That was the verdict, unlawful killing.
He's been in the middle of much of this. He's also obviously the leader of this conference of the parties, these COP organizations, along with people like David Attenborough and all these other oligarchs turning up at these things. I mean, I think that they have pretty much denuded our democracy, but it's important that there are people like you around, Sandy, just keeping abreast of the latest evidence about what they're up to. So just remind us of your Twitter address, and thanks very much for joining us.
I'm at Sandy Adams 2030 on Twitter. I've got a documentary coming out. Of course, that's quite a big thing. And we were supposed to be showing the whole thing a couple of weeks ago in London at the Emanuel Centre, but we ended up just having a talk. It's Mark Sharman from Oracle Films, and they made Safe and Effective, which was an amazing documentary about the whole vaccine rollout and the vaccine harms. And this is all about 2030. There's Aman Jabi, who worked for Silicon Valley for 24 years. He developed facial recognition, and he's whistleblowing on what the future is with the biometrics and how that all links up with your digital ID, and how it's amazing. And it's going to be the most incredible documentary. So look out for that one, and I'll put that out, Tony, when they're nearly finished editing. So anyway, it's coming out. Yeah.
Okay, Sandy Adams, thanks ever so much for joining us again.
Thank you. Thank you very much.